Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most familiar work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I am Elliot Diebold.
And we are back to talk about One After Another, which continues to be a very interesting arc as we get two more perspectives this week. 10.2, which is from Lucy's perspective, and then 10.D, which is from Alpi's perspective.
So here's a question for you, Ruben. Obviously, arc 5 was all the Aware as like a interlude arc sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then now 10 is the Canadullas. So what's arc 15 going to be from?
What other groups aware? Are there?
I suppose the other practitioners. Innocence.
Innocence, like, yeah.
It'll, random.
It'll just be the Kenneteers' parents arc.
Oh, just like the guy who runs the shop downtown.
Yeah. Oh, that's Todd. He sells hot dogs.
Yeah. Well, if Kenneth turns into like a proper, knotted place where like the rules of the Seal of Solomon stop applying and innocence isn't a thing, that could actually be really fun. Just watching a bunch of people's lives get ruined.
Yeah, that sounds like so much fun.
Yeah.
And on that note, speaking of watching people's lives get ruined, let's get into the chapters, shall we? So 10.2, we're from Lucy's perspective. As a reminder, we just had Nibble and Chloe approaching, and we switched to Lucy's perspective as she kind of hears them starting to approach, and Lucy suspects that they're about to get attacked, and she's correct, but not from the people she expects. Lucy and Avery and Melissa and Snowdrop begin sneaking out the back of Edith's cabin. Also, side note, we totally called it, I think you called it actually, or we kind of collectively called it last time that this chapter would be a Lucy chapter, so just putting it out there that we know what we're doing, we're professionals. We just got to revel in our successes. We've made a lot of predictions about who would be, you know, oh, I think this chapter is going to be next. And we're almost always wrong. So it's nice to get it right once.
Yeah, I was thinking that there was like the interlude at the end of Arc 8 or something. It's like, I don't know if I've ever predicted an interlude perspective correctly. Going right back to the start of Deep Impact. I'm going to start using these powers for good. Like, if I just start constantly declaring it's about to be a Brett interlude.
Oh, yeah, great. Oh, wait, sorry. So that will ward off a Brett interlude.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, cool. That is a good plan. So who's next, Elliot? Whose perspective?
Anyone but Brett.
No way. You meant it the other way around. You fucked us, Elliot. You fucked us.
So to get back to the chapter, I would just like to note before I make this next point that Pale Reflections and Doof Media's official stance is that getting children drunk is not a good thing. That said, I can't help but notice that every time it happens in the Otherverse, it's hilarious and I love it. Like rereading this chapter, knowing Melissa was drunk, just really added a level of hilarity to her antics.
Yeah, it's a fun reveal partway through the chapter, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It really encourages a reread, like, quite explicitly, because there's, like, a number of moments in the start where you're just like, Melissa's being weird. And then you find out she's drunk later, and I was just instantly like, I'm so glad I have to read these chapters twice this week. Like, this is a very good one to get to reread.
Yeah, good moments.
And there's, like, tons of little details. Like, she's vibing with Snowdrop a bunch, which I just thought was hilarious. Like, Snowdrop's just more open with her when she's like this. And then we'll get into it more later, but it's really obvious how patient Lucy's being with her in this first section on the reread. Like, I sort of noticed that, but I didn't quite give it the gravity that it deserved on my first pass.
Yeah.
But obviously that ties into all the stuff she goes through with Alyssa later on.
Yeah, you're right. There's a few things where once we find out what's been going on between Lucy and Melissa, it really recontextualizes it in an interesting way.
Yeah. I mean, the only downside to Melissa being drunk, aside from, you know, the general children being drunk stuff, etc., is, you know, it's gonna help leave her in this weird middle state of awareness that she's been in for ages now. Like, I feel like for at least a month, you and I have been like, every time there's a Melissa scene, we're like, well, that's it. She's a full-on aware now. And she always seems to not quite ever cross that threshold.
Mm.
Yeah. So I don't know. There's a line actually in this chapter where Nibble says she's close to being aware if she isn't there already, but she has that inherent innocence you can't give up unless you... And then Lucy interrupts him, which, fuck you, Lucy. I want to know how this works. yeah, so it seems to imply that there's some line you need to cross before you become, like, aware.
Legitimately aware, yeah, in quotes, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, you're right. It doesn't...
quite, because... just because you do have people like Clem. Like, Clem is aware, but she... too, I think, still has that innocence because she doesn't know everything.
Yes.
Whereas, like, Shelley does not meet that criteria. Shelley knows what's
There's
up.
There's definitely She's different crossed. Types of, yeah.
Well, I think it comes back to, because the Witch Hunter has obviously crossed that line. And there's a moment in his, I'm just going to, like, jump right ahead towards the end of mm-hmm. The next chapter, where he tries to kill the milkmaid and it doesn't work. And then there's, like, this moment where something dawns on him and, like, the colors of the thing. It's like this, I'm trying not to call it a trigger event, but that's the term I keep coming back to. I don't know, the clarity event.
Yeah, we saw something similar when the Kenneteers were made aware by the Kennet others, right? There's this clear moment of, like, oh shit, I'm recontextualizing all the things that my brain isn't able to just kind of push away anymore.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering if there's an aspect of agency to it, though, because, like, just thinking about how Melissa hasn't given up her inherent innocence or whatever, like, even with the Kenneteers, maybe if they hadn't awoken, they could have gone back home and slept it off and written it off as, like, a weird hallucination. I felt like it was the fact that Raph tries to kill the milkmaid and it doesn't work that was, like, part of what, yeah, like, tipped him over or something. Yeah. Like, there's an aspect of you engaging with the magic in a really tangible way that sort of crosses you over the line. Like, it doesn't have to be attempted murder, presumably, but there's, like, there's something where you have to be actively engaging in it by your own choice that, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, it's interesting that she hasn't crossed that line. I mean, maybe we will see that, you know, in the next little bit of time. I suspect we will. Yeah, I don't know. Just something to keep an eye on, I suspect.
Yeah. I mean, she's got a bit of an out this week because she was drunk for all of it, which I think helps.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, as you touched on before as well, this start of this chapter is having a lot of fun with the dramatic irony as well of us knowing that Nibble is here seeking their help, but Lucy's all like, oh, shit, they're onto us. They, you know, we're going to get attacked by the ghouls.
Yeah,
and of course we know that Nibble's like running up being like, god, my god, can you help me, this
we really need their help. yeah, it's quite fun, isn't it? I also just want to point out the bit where, you know, Lucy asks in a kind of way of checking what's after them, is he like you or is he like us? Is he a practitioner or is he another? And Nibble's response is neither. Mm. He's like her, indicating Melissa. Yeah. I mean, that's so scary, right? The thought of Melissa hearing this and, like, seeing and learning about this option of, like, being like she is now but becoming more scary. I'm very... I mean, we'll see more of this, I'm sure, over the course of this chapter, yes, and then in the future as well, presumably. It's very worrying that this is a path that is being offered to Melissa.
See, I am actually very pro Melissa going and becoming a witch hunter. So, yeah, let's talk about that.
When are we going to have that conversation, Elliot?
Yeah, well, later on, or probably towards the end. I think I've got a couple paragraph on
okay.
it later in the notes. But
yeah,
I just, again, like, I forced myself not to pull out every, like, laugh out loud bit of banter here, but, like, there's so many great moments, like, around that moment you just touched on where, like, Nibble's like, oh, he's like her, and Melissa's just like, okay, like, she's trying to, like, piece that together. It's great. There's the bit where she's like, am I the heir to a line of witch hunters with magical powers that have been crippled by some rival witch? And there's just, it's like, it's a bit heartbreaking because you're like, God, she's so desperate to just be like,
yeah,
part of the story.
It is such a sad one. It's that like desperation of nerdy kids in our generation of turning 11 and thinking, oh, maybe I will get a letter at Hogwarts, you know, kind of half joking way, but then also what if, you know.
I got Harry Potter stationery for like my 12th birthday.
Yeah.
And so I made my sisters letters from Hogwarts
and that's put so them mean
their pillows when they were asleep.
Elliot, you're a monster. They've one never of them forgiven believed you. Believed
it for a minute.
Oh.
It comes up at family like reunions every now and then because I do think it really got to one of them for a bit.
I mean, it's because it is that desire to just be like, what if this world was slightly more magical than it seems? Like, you know,
and that I'm special in it. Like,
yeah, you're starting to learn, actually, the world's kind of shitty sometimes. What if it but what if, you know? And for Melissa, the answer to that is, oh, yeah, the world is magical, but you shouldn't. But no, we don't want you to be a part of it. Like, I can think of nothing more heartbreaking.
Yeah, exactly. And this is like, this joke is her desperately trying to, like, cling on to that hope that there's something for her. Because that's what she just doesn't have at the moment, and she obviously gets into that explicitly. Also, this like TV show that her and Avery talk about, it has a half centaur, which just what's a half centaur?
It's a human.
A centaur's already a half. Like I don't.
A half centaur is just a human. It's like the old joke of a person whose parents were a centaur and a mermaid.
Yeah, and they're just
As a human. Anyway,
it's just the Pactverse has the weirdest fucking kids programs. Like it that's so, such an unnecessary level of conception for a children's program.
The group starts to run away from this witch hunter. They call in their favorite pet dog, John, and they start kind of investigating these bells that they find.
I am kind of worried for John because he's very much become just such a staple or like almost a crutch for the Kenneteers. Like, you know, you talked about it, Russell. He's like, every time something starts to go wrong, it's just instantly throw some dog tags down. And knowing Wildbo's stories, I don't think Wildbo will let that continue being the status quo for too much longer.
Yeah, they call him in anytime there's any kind of conflict, and I think that's going to cause problems, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's the sort of tool where I don't think Wildbo will leave it in their hands for too much longer because he'll want to, like, spice things up or something. So, doylistically, I'm worried.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
Yeah, I love this investigation of the bells scene. I love the little detail of how they're sensitive to everyone to different degrees. Like mostly the fact that Avery is doubly as bad as Lucy, which I guess has something to do with Snowdrop and her connection to Snowdrop now, but it's just like a nice little, again, another little tangible example of what their familiar ritual has done to them.
Yeah, I think it's a fun little moment of how mystical are you, Detector? It's just a fun little piece of the world, I guess.
I wonder what Verona would have been at.
Yeah, it's a good question.
You think the implement would help Lucy's score push her further away from it, but you know, Verona's probably permanently covered in the scent of glamour, so I don't know.
Yeah. Presumably wouldn't have been great.
And then they start diagnosing this thing, which again is super fun. I love how Wildbo sort of introduced this high-level broad system to us in the 9.Z extra material, and now we're just, like, actually using it in this. Like, this is something Pale has done time and time again that I find so fun, which is just come up with these incredibly rich and well-explained systems and then put them to use in a way where it's fun for me to follow along and be like, oh, yes, this tells us no.
Yeah, I really like the way you break down these cards being dealt that we see. I think you do a really good job, so I'm excited for you to share it with our listeners.
Oh, God, now the pressure's too high.
Yeah, hype.
Because obviously one of the things that happens is Avery, being the novice witch that she is, just brought like a regular deck of cards, not a tarot deck.
Mm.
Which I found out doing this research is actually like the normal deck of cards is referred to as like a French deck. I found websites that had like the meanings of what all the French deck cards mean, but they were clearly bullshit. I mean, obviously all of this is bullshit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was clearly just somebody doing a creative writing project and posting it as if it was fact. So what I sort of figured out, I think, is that the spirits were just doing the best that they could to map the tarot cards to the French deck cards. So like the, you know, there's all these comparisons, like, you know, the pentacles or the coins in tarot correspond to the diamonds because they're both like material earthly stuff. Similarly, like spade, John brings up that spades are swords, and violence and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, just looking into the meanings of the cards that Avery pulled, like she got the, she got the Ace of Diamonds, which if it corresponds to the Ace of Coins in tarot, that's all about like having new materials, like new wealth. So basically, like, I think it's implying about the bells that they're quite new. Possibly even talking about Raph, and maybe he's only been at the lighthouse for a little while. I mean, I don't know what your read is on the timeline for Raph being a witch hunter.
Yeah, I mean, I can see him being relatively new. Having said that, though, he seems hyper competent.
Yeah, like I'd be more inclined to think this is more of a statement on the bells, and it's more about the fact that he kind of is making them all the time, so they're relatively new.
Yeah, I can see that.
And then, Avery also gets the Two of Clubs, which corresponds to the Two of Wands, which is all about basically like planning stuff and having patience, kind of, which makes sense because he fucking put out like a couple hundred bells in a field and in the forest. Like, that's meticulous as fuck.
Yep. Makes sense given how he's acting.
And then the fun one is, so Avery actually pulled two Jacks of Diamonds.
Yes, which is so confusing.
Yeah, but something that was brought up when I was looking at the comparisons between French and tarot cards is, so the tarot deck has four picture cards, like as well as King and Queen. It doesn't have Jack. Instead, it has the Knight and the Page. So the Knight and the Page kind of got merged into the Jack for the French version. So I'm guessing that this is the spirits wanting to do the Page and the Knight, and just like, this was the best they could do. They're like, oh shit, have another Jack, I guess. And, you know, hopefully that'll let you know that we mean both of these things. Yeah. And so like the Jack of Diamonds and will correspond to both, like the Page of Coins. So one of them is like someone who's young or like someone new. So again, seems like a hint that Raph is relatively new at this, or the bells are a relatively new acquisition.
But it's strange to be to hit the newness beat a few times, right? Like, I can see the Ace of Coins saying the bells being new, but the Page of Coins definitely implies Raph is pretty green, right?
Or maybe, like, because with all this tarot stuff, it's so interpretive. Maybe it's less he's new and more he has a lot ahead of him, like, which is a subtle difference. But maybe, like, the point is meant to be that, you know, he's not set in his ways or something. Like, I'd associate age as much with, like, an inability to change. I don't know. I'm grasping at straws because I want them to make friends with him. I'm trying to fit that together. And so then lastly, the Knight of Coins, the other Jack of Diamonds, basically represents like stubbornness, hard workmanship. I mean, you know, we talked about it last week and we'll probably talk about it a lot over the next two chapters, but Raph's pretty clearly stubborn as hell because he's on this crusade. So that tracks for explaining him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I love this. I think it works so well and perfectly explains the double jacks, which is so weird and confusing initially. So great stuff.
I love poor Avery though, because she's like, she just bought a deck of cards and now she's getting two Jack of Diamonds. Like, do the spirits change it back when she shuffles them back in?
Yeah,
is her deck just fucked now?
That deck's fucked now.
Or is it an extra card? Is she going to pull it out and she's got 53 cards plus some jokers or something?
Oh yeah, A pretty good magic trick on the whole.
Yeah, no, so like you know, obviously this, I've rambled on about all these cards for a while now, but like I just love how Wildbo can include these systems like this and then put them in here and we get to play with them. Like it's just something Pale has given us so much of.
Mm.
Remember the runes in Arc 1 and 2?
Yeah.
And trying to guess about Lucy's smoke machine and stuff. Like it's, huge fun. Good stuff.
Yeah. 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 So, we have this bell scene. Actually, you pulled this bit out when as stuff starts getting chaotic and Raph starts shooting at our team. There's a line where Melissa says, "Shit on me!" as a kind of exclamation, and Snowdrop urges her to shh.
Yeah, well, I pulled this out because I was like, wait, shouldn't Snowdrop's shushes be inverted? Because the fact that it's in speech stuff in text tells me that it's like words. So I would have expected it to be inverted. This is such a nothing point that I'm bringing up here. I'm just like, it just surprised me that that's not inverted.
But Elliot, you've forgotten the obvious read, which is that when Melissa says shit on me, Snowdrop wants to know more about what she's talking about. So she's not actually shushing her. She's saying, oh, what? Yeah, tell me more or whatever. And it gets translated to shush.
I see. So like there's more Goblin in Snowdrop than I realized. And she's actually interested in that as a proposition.
Yes. Exactly. The group kind of tests these bells and starts setting them off, and the witch hunter starts shooting. To escape, Lucy does a cool trick where she sets them all off, and the group tries to run away, but someone gets shot.
Yeah, this was a mean trick by Wildbo, because like my first thought was, oh, it's probably John, it's fine. And then he waves it as a cliffhanger. I was like, oh, God, is it not John?
It is John. I had the same thought of like, again, 90% it's John and it's fine. But then, yeah.
Yeah, the Wobble lets you stew in it. It took me a second to put this Lucy part together. I don't know exactly what it was, but like you know, Avery's sort of like, oh, silence is your thing, and Lucy doesn't ever really have the thought of, oh, instead of silence I'm gonna like set them all off. But like as you see it happening, I was just like, oh fuck, that's cool. Like rather than trying to hide by turning them all off, just setting them all off and causing chaos is such a great way to stage a getaway. I loved it.
Yeah it's a good strategy, isn't it? Great stuff by Lucy.
And the bullets, they go on for a lot here about like, you've got to like bury a soldier with 99 bullets, and then you put in a special 100th one and you pull it out and it's got like super gravity or whatever.
Yeah.
What a huge amount of work for a bullet.
Well, I mean, it's kind of emphasizing how dedicated to murder Raph is. Like, he's either spent a lot of effort or a lot of money on someone else who spent effort equipping himself to murder these monsters. So, he's really, I mean, considering how this fight goes, it's working, right? Like, he shuts them down hardcore.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these things keep John down, which we haven't seen many things do. I mean, I'm just thinking, though, this would explain why there's, like, gaps between each of his shots usually, because he probably has to go pick up the bullets, because, like, that would be my thing, is if each bullet's costing me, like, $1,000, I'm going to go pick them up afterwards if I miss.
You go get them after, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So that explains why he's moving around so much and only taking shots every now and then. He's got to go find his bullets.
Yeah, and it explains why he's going to try and shoot Lucy at the end, because from his perspective, she's trying to steal his expensive bullets from inside of John.
He was just passing through. He didn't.
Yeah. He didn't really want to kill Lucy. He was just like, hey, that's my bullet.
Stop someone from stealing his bullet.
Yeah. He's a very relatable character. It's all a big
misunderstanding.
So anyway, we cut back to earlier in the day. Lucy is getting ready to say goodbye to Booker and tangentially Alyssa, but gets the call from Avery that Melissa needs their help. Now, Elliot, is it just a coincidence that the name Alyssa sounds so similar to the name Melissa, or is there something going on there?
I mean, it's a bit of a pain because I guarantee you I'm going to say the wrong name for one of them before the end of this episode. but no, I don't think there's some grand conspiracy here.
Okay. All right. Well,
neither of them are practitioners.
Okay. We'll see.
I mean, it would be a hell of a twist that Melissa was a practitioner the whole time.
That would be a very unexpected twist.
Avery, as well, I just want to point out, like, when she calls Lucy to give her this news, I loved how relatably, like, unsure Avery was with all this, because she sort of finds out that it's Booker and Alyssa are leaving, and Avery's like, oh, God, well, I can't ask you now. I'd feel like a dickhead.
Yeah.
Like, Lucy's really good about it. She has this knack for being really just, like, upfront with how she's like, just tell me, I'm going to feel like a dickhead for leaving, but, like, you know, if that's what you think, you need to tell me, which is, like, really encouraging, but I couldn't help but relate to Avery being like, oh, just do it myself. This is too awkward.
Yeah. It sucks for Lucy, but she's very, she's dedicated, isn't she?
Yeah, she's always been the one who can focus on the mission. Yeah, she obviously has mixed feelings. Like, she thinks about this for the rest of the chapter, obviously, that, like, it's shitty that this is happening tonight. She also gets Matt on the phone, which we should point out, because he gives her a warning. He's like, oh, yeah, by the way, don't go out. Like, he doesn't say that it's...
He doesn't say what it is, yeah.
Yeah.
From how he says it, it doesn't sound like he's warning against the witch hunter either. It just sounds like he's kind of saying, like, oh, the vibe of angriness around Kennet is ramped up or something, right? That's what it felt like to me, at least.
I totally read it as Matt being like, okay, I'm not allowed to tell them that the witch hunter's here.
Mm.
So I'm just going to, like, you know, like, because he's sort of like, oh, because, yeah, he dresses it up in, like, I think he talks about, like, Monty saying stuff as well and stuff. But, like, I very much read it as him. Maybe because I've still kind of got my finger on this theory that Matt is, like, working under duress from Edith or something and Marissica. But I definitely read it as him, like, because, you know, we've known since 5.D that he actually really respects the Kenneteers. So I view this as him, like, without being able to say it, trying to tell Lucy not to go out while the witch hunter's in town.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think I agree with it. But to play devil's advocate, he also mentions that John has said that things are dangerous. So if Matthew didn't mention this now and they find out from John, which almost certainly would happen, that would be highly suspicious. So there is a read where he's still being, he's like leaking them the minimum possible amount of information to still cover his ass for later, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I agree with you. I think Matthew is on Team Kenneteer and is just caught in a hard place.
Yeah, I see what you mean. There's definitely, I think both reads make sense. So we'll just have to find out.
So Lucy waits for her mum and Booker to have this D&M that they're having so she can say goodbye. But with no options left for anything else to do, she finally talks to Alyssa, who finally mercifully receives a big old thumbs up.
This is such a great conversation. Like, I just, these two work off each other in a very fun way. And just, I was so inordinately happy for Alyssa that she was finally getting this. Like, there's just all these moments where Lucy says stuff like, I won't hate it if you keep dating Booker. And, like, in my head, I was like, fuck, that's huge. This, like, Alyssa's finally done it. She's got the familial stamp of approval. Like, Jazz approves of you. Don't give a shit. Lucy says she doesn't hate you. You've done it. You've won.
Yeah.
You're officially the girlfriend.
It's nice, isn't it? I had the same reaction of, like, it was so nice. And also, it feels like Alyssa has earned it. It doesn't seem like Lucy has just kind of given this out because she thinks it's the right thing to do. Alyssa seems great. I actually expect something more is going to happen with Alyssa, because I don't think it's enough for Alyssa to be here just as a kind of demonstration of Lucy's growth in terms of not being so protective of Booker. You know, I think there's going to be a twist on the way that Alyssa is involved somehow, and I'm very excited to find out what that is.
Yeah. I don't know. There's obviously, she has a bit of a moment here because she gives this advice about being compassionate that does drive Lucy forward. So there may already be something there with the whole expanding beyond just looking to Booker as an idol, because that's obviously something Lucy has done a lot.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely hope you're right, because, like, I'd love to see more Alyssa. This conversation she and Lucy have is just very, as I already said, they have a very fun dynamic. Like, I liked the way they worked off each other. There's this great moment where Lucy hesitates right at the start because she's like, oh, I don't want to ask about Booker. That's like a 5 out of 10 personal topic, and I don't want to jump straight there. And then pretty much immediately as soon as they start talking, launches into a whole speech on how racist the entire world is, which...
Yeah, I mean, it gets right into systemic racism right off the bat.
Yeah, which, like, at first for me, I was like, well, shit, that's above a 5 out of 10. But then I was like, well, actually, no, I suppose for Lucy, this is just her life. Like, that's not... She probably wouldn't view that as, like, as personal a topic, I suppose, because that's just, like, the world she deals with every day. Yeah, and then obviously, I think Alyssa gets a lot of points for how she responds to pretty much everything Lucy brings up.
Yeah, no, definitely. Alyssa does very, very well. There's a moment in here where Alyssa is saying that she likes how Lucy kind of has this style where she fits into a group and implies and mentions that it's kind of like being a part of a band. And Lucy says, it's not wrong, it's kind of a band. Alyssa asks, is it a secret? And Lucy says, yeah, for now at least. Which I know could just be practitioner talk for Lucy covering her ass, but it also kind of, she didn't need to say that. It kind of gave me an implication that Lucy is potentially thinking about revealing this to some people, and maybe to play off my earlier thought that Alyssa is going to play more of a role somehow. Maybe that's what Alyssa could be, like somebody that's distant enough to not be too worried about getting them involved, but close enough to kind of be trustworthy. I don't know. It just felt weird to me that Lucy said, for now at least, when she really didn't have to. Maybe I'm just diving too deep into it though.
Yeah, it could be a nothing line, like just sort of yeah. I don't know. I didn't read anything into it, but I can't refute what you're saying. I'm still kind of hoping they wrote Booker in. He seems like the sort of person I'd want as a practitioner.
Yeah, he would be pretty good, wouldn't he? But Lucy would be, there's no way Lucy would ever let that happen, you know what I mean?
No, which I mean, she's right, like, you know. You don't want your friends inducted into the practice.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
There's also a moment as well in this conversation where Alyssa asks if there's been any news on Verona. And Lucy just sort of says, she's hanging at the beach or whatever. And the process has started. And what process? Is this beluga, sleeping belugas process with the CBS? I hate that we get this little tidbit dropped and then just nothing. Like Lucy ending this little like one sentence summary of what's up with Verona with, I don't know. I was like, how dare you?
Yeah, I wonder what process. Like CPS feels kind of right, but again, it feels impossible to predict what's going to actually happen here. I do know Verona's going to be pissed that she missed all the Witch Hunter stuff though.
She shouldn't be. It seems like it's going to be awful. Yeah, I mean, and also, you know, she's at the beach, right? Which probably isn't so much her vibe, but I bet Tashlet's having a great time.
True. Alyssa gives Lucy some advice and even gets a hug as Lucy heads out to tackle the Melissa problem. But on the way, she runs into, I guess, what can be described as an even worse version of Melissa. New Melissa Plus.
I love... How so? The advice Alyssa gives Lucy here is obviously this thing of like, you try coming at people from a point of compassion.
Yes, start from compassion. Great advice.
And I love how this ties into everything Lucy's been dealing with since leaving the Blue Heron Institute. Like this goes right back to all that stuff where she was dropping the knife, like, and trying to figure out who she wanted to be, because there's this. Like the way Alyssa frames it really sold it to me, where she's like, coming at things with compassion first won't guarantee or even necessarily improve your odds of success, but you're going to feel a lot better about yourself afterwards. And I feel like that's probably part of why this actually is something Lucy considers, because that I don't think any of us think she did any wrong things, really, with Alexander and Bristow, but she's obviously not fully happy with how it went down in the end. And so this knowledge that at least if you try with compassion first and give that a shot, you'll be able to rest easier knowing you tried, like, really made sense to me. Especially for problems like Melissa specifically.
Yeah, it's good advice, I think. It's like, it's strong advice, because the real thing is Lucy is going to do all she can in this situation. And if something doesn't go her way, she's going to probably kick herself about it a bunch. So minimize the amount that you're going to kick yourself about it by starting doing what you think is gives you the best chance of doing that, right? And it, you know, we'll see that maybe it doesn't work here. Sorry, not it doesn't work here with Brett, because she doesn't do it with, here with Brett, and I don't think she should. But it does work later with Mel. Like, it works out very, very well. So,
yeah,
strong advice.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah, definitely. And it's the same with, like, Bristow. Like, compassion was only going to get you so far, but it's a thing where you got to at least give it a try, I guess. But, like, maybe not even someone with Bristow.
Yeah.
Definitely with Melissa. Yeah, I guess we should get to the Brett incident. But I want to start that by talking about this fucking horror movie play she does where he sees her as a fox, and as he goes in to get food, she just stands on the same spot but turns back into a human.
It's pretty baller. Such
a good play.
Yeah.
Putting all those horror movies she's watched to use. Because this was, just imagine this if you were Brett. You see this little fox, you duck in, and the second, like, Lucy's just standing there fucking glaring at you.
It's pretty baller, isn't it? Yeah.
And yeah, Lucy does a really good job of framing herself as the victim here. But never to be outdone, Brett, you know, makes himself the victim. And he has this one comment where he goes, "I always mess up, apparently. According to Verona, according to my wife, and blah blah blah." And I might be overinterpreting things here, but it felt telling to me that he says wife and not, like, ex-wife.
Mm. It's weird. You're right. It is weird, though.
Yeah, it could just be, like, even a typo. But I choose to read it as a statement on how Brett just hasn't really moved on from how he thinks things should be.
Mm. Yeah, a failure to move on. I like that diagnosis.
Yeah, and then obviously Lucy starts just yelling at him, and I love that, because there's just, she thinks to herself right before she starts doing it, okay, start from compassion. And immediately after having that thought, she just yells, "Fuck off." It's so good.
It is good. Yeah, I'm glad she didn't start from compassion with this one, you know. I guess this exposes the flaw in what Alyssa was saying, where sometimes you shouldn't, like, I think Lucy would feel bad if she did start from compassion with this one.
Well, I think it's really interesting that we do that. Like the fact that Wabo is, like, establishes this new thing of, okay, you should start from compassion, and then immediately has a thing where Lucy either fails to or decides not to do it. Like, it's interesting. I almost wonder if, like, she's stewing in this thing with Brett for a while afterwards. Like, she leaves this and she's really pissed. And I wonder if that's a little part of it. Is she's like, the fact that she's still so angry after dealing with Brett for that short thing, she's like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do the compassion thing.
Mm.
Because that, like, you know, hopefully I'll be less angry afterwards. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah. Just to really round this part out, Lucy tells Brett to go to therapy, and his response is, "You keep going to your therapy, Lucy. It seems like you need it," which is just a great way for Wabo to end this scene, making sure that we definitely have no thought that Brett will ever be redeemed. He is irredeemable. Like, he's crossed that line to me. He's irredeemable now.
I don't know. I feel like I have this character flaw where I'm never quite willing to give up on anyone, even Brett. But, God, he's not doing
himself. No, he's become more of a villain than any other character from Wapa work, you know. Asta, any of the other ones, the real irredeemable villains.
Taylor. anyway.
Yeah, but it's horrible. It's horrifying. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, Lucy leaves that piece of shit and meets up with Snow and Avery at the parking lot. They shadow Biscuit's hopes and dreams and agree to work with and help Melissa.
I can't believe they did this to my gal Biscuit. She just wants her Barney, and these fucking Killjoys come in and they ruin everything. They're just like that square Kim who's been ruining my life in the past week.
Yeah, fuck Kim. But Biscuit's reaction to this is so cute, isn't it? It's so adorable. I love it. She just has a full-on meltdown, and it's great. Like a toddler-level meltdown.
Yeah, I love how she starts it with, like, puppy dog eyes, and Lucy's comment is, she's actually surprisingly good at that for a goblin. There's also this detail where Snowdrop looks more like put together, which I, you know, that's nice that the ritual is helping her.
Yeah, it's nice. It's working out for her, I suppose. Or is it good for her to be more put together? I guess it is. It can't be a bad thing, right?
Yeah, I had that thought where I was like, it's a little bit like assimilate-y, like where it's like, oh, she's more in the system now, so she gets to be more okay. But I don't know. I think it's hopefully just representative of the fact that she's not like, you know, coming apart at the seams and only has like 2 years left to live.
Yeah, you're right. So definitely a good sign by that metric.
And yeah, oh, we should talk about, what do we think about Wildbow's answer to our discussion question? Yeah, I mean, obviously, Lucy has seemingly decided that, okay, if Melissa is going to go down this road, we may as well help her pick a path that we can help her stay as safe on as we can, and we'll kind of make her happy. And I like this as a solution.
Yeah, it's a good solution, isn't it? Like, it and the best proof for it being a good solution is it works so well. Like, when we get to the end of this chapter, we will mention Melissa effectively is willing to die for this group because they just take her in and do some very small gestures of it, you know? Like, yeah. Good strategy. Thumbs up, Alyssa.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, there's like a lot of overlap here with like Avery-esque sort of issues and imagery. And like a big one there is like, this reminds me of that conversation Avery had with Zed, where it's like he just needed somebody to reach out. And that's kind of like Melissa has been telling these guys to fuck off. And they just keep showing up. And Lucy, like, is very honest with her, where, you know, when she's coming at her with this compassion, she's like, yeah, look, I'm going to be honest with you. Part of the reason we're here is because, like, we were told to come and deal with you. But also, yeah, like, the reason we haven't killed you or anything is because I actually care about you and I want to try and find a good way out of this. And that, I think that part of it finally hits Melissa. And she's like, okay, these guys actually give a shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a strong strategy. Like, you know, Melissa was defined by being part of the dance group. She lost that social circle, and she explicitly says she kind of just needs to be needed.
Yeah,
it's great. I also want to point out my favorite part of this conversation, when I think Lucy, or maybe it's Avery, I'm not sure, says to Melissa, come, walk. And Melissa's response is, look, Mr. Blind Man, look at that. Listen, Mr. Deaf Guy, do you hear that? Now march, cripple girl. Dance, cripple girl. Do a flip. It just made me cackle out loud. It's such a fucking great response.
She has a number of zingers in this chapter.
Once she pulls herself together and stops being so annoying, she's going to be such a delightful addition to the Genetiers.
Well, because she can do sarcasm. That's her superpower as an aware, is that she can lie and do sarcasm, the most powerful form of lying.
It's brilliant. Yeah. Maybe that's her power as an aware, is she'll be allowed to kind of Snowdrop-esque, but for sarcasm.
I really like this as a kind of moment where all the Melissa stuff finally comes to a head. Because as you said, with all those other groups, the thing was, is the moment she wasn't useful, they dumped her, whereas like I think what seals the deal here is Lucy's kind of like, okay, like we're going to find a way to make you fit, and we're going to do the best we can to integrate you. And that's what she hasn't really had. She's been the one to join groups and like put herself in them. She hasn't been asked to come, even when she's quote unquote useless. I mean, it just validates everything Alyssa was saying. Like, you know, Lucy comes from this with compassion, and it finally sort of clicks for Melissa.
Yeah, great stuff.
Also worth comparing this to Sig not Sig directly, but in Sig's interlude, remember when the girl by candlelight showed up and she had the TikTok girl, and the TikTok girl was all like, please, I want to stay, and you know, I can help, and girl by candlelight was like, no, fuck you, we don't need help. to shut her down. This is like the Can of Tears being expressly better than the Girl by Candlelight, because they took the useless idiot who's doing bad things and tried to make them better.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't think it's hard for the Can of Tears to be better than GBC, morally speaking, but yeah, you're right. It is a good a juxtaposition there.
Yeah.
So yeah, we jump forward in time again. John, who was the one who got shot, Wapo, nice try. We knew it though. Nice try. John is not reviving thanks to these magic gravity bullets. There's a very kind of chaotic fight / chase, but Raph ends up cornering Lucy and Melissa.
Yeah, and I love how like scrambled and chaotic this fight is. I think both of the fights in this chapter, much like the like Abyss Beast fight at the end of Arc 9, felt like particularly just like really visceral, I guess, compared to something like the wolf, where, you know, you're fighting the wolf in this fucking magical path, and also it's like a giant wolf, depending on whose perspective you're in. But, you know, that's like, it's so, those fights are sort of almost so fantastical that they tickle very different bones than like these ones where, like, you know, Lucy's just like digging into John's stomach to try and yank a bullet out. And like that moment is fucking full on. And like, you know, dragging his corpse around as like, you know, Avery's fucking getting a concussion or whatever from an elbow to the face. Like moments like that just make these fights feel really chaotic and visceral.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. The fact that it's effectively a guy with a gun, it makes it very... a different vibe, right? He just kind of is striding through this field full of monsters and putting them down. It's it's scary stuff.
Yeah, you're right, because even like compared to the Abyss Beast, fights, it's a bit more on the fantastical end because it was a giant shadow beast. Whereas yeah, like this one is very much just like, yeah, and the one in the next chapter too. It's just, you know, very, it feels a lot more human, and that somehow makes it, those violent moments hit me way harder.
Yeah, definitely.
I also want to call out the, just because let's all keep thinking about the time where Lucy was digging into John's stomach. Just keep that image in your head. It's a fun one. It feels like a specific callback to the wolf doing the same thing in 10.A, only like, Lucy does it to help because she needs John, whereas like the wolf was doing it for the opposite reasons, like, you know, obviously trying to literally tear him apart. I just think it's like another fun mirroring of like,
yeah,
these two.
I didn't think of that, but having pointed it out, it makes a lot of sense. It is another fun, a fun mirroring, and specifically a fun mirroring for it to be Lucy doing this with John, right? As a representation of her being kind of a reflection of Yolda.
Yeah, and because we didn't really get into this when we covered 10.A. I didn't leave 10.A with the best impression of Yolda, and I'm not even talking about the wolf Yolda. I'm talking about, like, Yolda pre-getting shot in the head by John.
Interesting. What makes you say that?
It's just that it was mostly just that one line where she tells John, like, to kill her, and she's sort of like, there's important people, you'll be elevated because of this, like, use that duty. And it just, like, we know John enough to know that's not what he wants, and it just felt kind of a dick move for Yolda to, like, put pressure on him to do it. Like, maybe I'm being unfair, but, like, it just felt like her, yeah, unfairly pressuring
yeah,
him to
it's interesting.
Step into roles he doesn't want.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. I think we've seen a very, very limited view of Yolda, so it's hard to make a solid judgment on her, but yeah, fair enough.
I guess, like, my actual read on it would maybe be, we know that John has kind of, like, got this really high regard image of Yolda in his head that stems right back to his early days, where she was, like, he and the other dogs lent on her as this embodiment of, like, you know, the children and the home that they're trying to protect, and that was why they came back to Canada to, like, get her away from the war. And it's probably fair to assume that Yolda had the same thing going towards John, where she saw him as like the big ultimate soldier man who never had any emotions or whatever, and maybe was like doing some problematic idolization of him the other way, and that's what led to like a moment like that where she just didn't really see him for who he was.
Makes sense to me.
Anyway, sorry, this is like 2 weeks late. Actually, speaking of thoughts that are 2 weeks late, the other thing I had relating to 10.A, so John gets things from the people he kills, right? And he killed Alexander in the head.
Mm.
He presumably got a bunch of Alexander's ambition.
Hmm.
That feels important. Like, because he got a bunch of Alexander's, like, knowledge or auger or like, he got the sight, but, like, it seems ridiculous that, you know, he shot that one kid in the heart and kind of got that kid's heart. I have to imagine he got some of Alexander's ambition. And maybe that relates to how he was talking to the Sable at the end. Like, maybe he started engaging with the other judges a lot more after killing Alexander.
Interesting. Interesting. I could see it. I could see it. I think we haven't got any indication of it yet, but it seems like a kind of thing that might become important once things start unraveling.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I did leave 10.A a bit confused about, you know, and by design, like what John wants, what he's trying to do. And maybe part of that is because it has changed quite recently.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. So Raph tries to negotiate with Melissa, but he hasn't learned. Talking to Melissa never works out how you want it to. Guillaume and the rest of the backup arrive and he runs away. Well played, Melissa.
Oh, yeah, she really... Yeah, I mean, we'll leave the talk of most of the implications of this chat till next chapter. But, like, you got to give props to Melissa here. She finally fucking does the right thing. And, yeah, like, it feels like this really great reward to Lucy for sticking by her, and it feels like this great moment for Melissa where she actually gets to have something worth standing up for, which is what she hasn't had for ages. It's like they both... Oh, yeah, Lucy kept trying. Melissa finally sort of belongs. She's giving that up. I just really love this as a bit of a climax moment for both of them.
Yeah. Isn't it so... Fuck. It's so good. Mm. Melissa, you're a champion. I take back all the negative things I have said and will say about you.
No, I don't. Shape up. But, yeah, especially I love how, like, baffled Raph is that he can't figure out how they're paying her. It's like, you know, because he's sort of like, oh, I'm honorable, I'll give you 5%, which, like, okay, 5%, sure. But yeah, just, yeah, I don't know. This whole thing where, he's sort of like, oh, are they paying you in healing or are they going to give you this or that? And you kind of understand that, like, it's just not how the Kenneteers operate. Obviously, we'll see more of that next chapter.
Mm. Yes, we will. So yeah, then the chapter ends on a reveal of something that's been teased for a bit. Melissa found something in Edith's cabin, a fey syringe with dark glamour and Edith's face inside it.
Oh, boy. This is fun.
Yeah. What do you think this is, Elliot?
I don't... Wait. It feels like, from what I've seen on, like, Discord and stuff, that most people seem to have fairly confidently come to the assumption that it's, like, doom juice, or that it's, like, something to do with the doom, but, like, I don't know, the fact that it's dark could just be that it's dark fall glamour, because obviously the syringe, it's Marissica's, like, the text pretty much says that without saying it.
The text says it's artistry that could only have come from one place, which pretty much does imply fey craftsmanship, which I think meant to think it means Marissica at the very least.
Well, yeah, especially the way Guillaume shows up and Lucy's kind of like, oh, that's good. That tracks with what we found. So she definitely thinks it's Marissica's. And I'm inclined to just go with Lucy until shown otherwise. So, yeah, I mean, all that I know for sure is just in case anybody had doubt, this seems to even more heavily imply that Marissica is involved with Edith. But, like, yeah, like, is this, like, there's so many things this could be. I love the idea that it's doom juice and they're maybe injecting Matthew with doom juice to make the doom more powerful for some reason. But it could just be Edith based glamour. Maybe Edith's body is actually pretty much dead and this is like a glamour copy that the girl by candlelight is using to survive. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It could be anything, right? And the real frustrating thing to me is I'm not sure if it means Edith is less guilty or more guilty.
Well, that's the thing. Like, yeah, is this something that's being used on Edith? Is it being used on Matt? Is Marissica using it to fake being one of them? Like,
yeah.
there's so, like, the thing with glamour and this story is there's so many fucking options still. It could be any of them.
Yeah, could be anything. Who knows? I'm sure we will find out more about it soon, though.
Oh, yeah.
Next chapter we're going to get into is the next chapter in the story, which I think is a pretty good idea, just doing them sequentially.
Makes sense.
We are going to be talking about One After Another 10.D, which is from Alpi's perspective.
And it uses an Avery cover image, not a Verona one. So suck it, Verona, you lost.
Yeah, bad luck, Verona. I feel like Verona's moved off the Alpi train and is on the Tashlet train now anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they've both moved on, but still, you know, just this was a beef that went throughout most of the story, so it's nice to know the answer.
Yeah, it's a good confirmation, textual confirmation. So yeah, Alpi is waiting for our witch hunter to fall asleep and begins preparing the hotel for her attempt to subsume him. Can we just point out, this guy doesn't fall asleep until 6 a.m., which is fucking crazy. And I was kind of thinking about, like, if you're a witch hunter, do you want to be kind of nocturnal? And the answer is no. You want to hunt things in the daytime when you're safe. So this is just setting up how wrong and evil and reckless of a villain Raph is and how irredeemable he is.
Yeah, but isn't he, like, college student aged? Like,
oh, yeah. So maybe this is just a remnant from, you know, yeah, late night study sessions or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good point. Like, I suppose he was up most of the night hunting Chloe and Nibble, and John and Lucy, et cetera, et cetera. I want to call out before we start to go into Alpi's dreamland. It basically, Raph kind of blocks her from accessing him by closing a curtain, and she's like, "Oh, geez, that's enough of a fucking barrier for me." And I just love this as a metaphor for who Alpi is as a person, like the fact that this is how she operates, because she's one of those people, you know, she like lives for her work and she's just so focused on her work. And like, you know, she has that whole thing about not getting into the politics of the town. It's like the only way to get things to get her involved in stuff is sort of like to have it affect her work, because she's always like, oh, this makes my work so much harder. Like, that's about 80% of what she says in this story is like complaints about people making her job harder. So this idea that she's this person who just lives for her work and thinks everything's fine and the system is just the way it is, and she only really gets like roped into things when it's sort of affecting that, like, is just so perfect. It's like, you know, you can just put up the smallest barrier, and if it, you know, doesn't directly interfere with her, she's just kind of like, well, that'll stop me.
Yeah.
Like, she's very neutral in that Bristonian sense. Like, you know, when Bristow and Lucy had that whole conversation about what neutrality is.
Yeah.
Alpi's very much the sort who's like, oh, you know, I have to remain neutral, which means not taking sides.
Yeah. She's interesting, isn't she? Like, I don't know. I guess we'll talk about this in a moment, but her complete unwillingness to analyze or even think about the task that she has been assigned doesn't make her come off well in this chapter, right?
No, exactly. It's all that sort of thing. She's just like, there's so much of her vibe is just like, well, that's the way it is. Like, this is my job. I don't want to think about that stuff. Like, she's the sort of,
yeah,
bury her head in the sand with regards to politics sort of stuff. And that just means you give her the slightest barrier and she's just going to be like, well, okay, not going down that way, unless you sort of force her to.
Yeah. It's, we'll talk about that in a bit more, I think.
And then obviously we should talk about all, like, so then she starts to put people into the dreams. And I just love how, again, this is like another interlude where Wildbow fits in just like a whole functional magic system. This reminded me of our pilot season episode on Sandman, which I guess just because it's magic and dreams, but, like, dreams just feel like such a natural fit for the other verse. It was really cool to see them in action.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of these dream components that we'll see over the course of this chapter are so much fun. I mean, it's a perfect representation of the other verse, because it's effectively the concept of ideas and concepts being tangibly used by Alpi. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, but it's that broken layer of dream stuff, which is used in a really cool way. But we'll probably get that for as she gets deeper in there. But I love how this stuff is established. Like, Alpi gives us a very brief overview of, like, how dreams are made up, and there's all these things that are like based on, you know, old sleep words or like scientific ones, like you know, the NIMIs and the REMs.
Mm.
And just like it really, it's a really cool way for setting up the premise of this interlude, because Alpi does it in these sort of low stakes children's dreams at first, and we kind of get to get introduced to it and see her interact with these things, and it's like training us for when she's going to be doing it in the high stakes situation with the witch hunter.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. It's yeah, it's a good setup, isn't it? It like sets up the way that Alpi works, sets up those mechanics that you were just mentioning, but also setting up the like motifs that Alpi is going to work into this first encounter with the witch hunter later. It's just a very fun setup section.
Yeah, you're right. Because it's the other verse, and because Wabo knows he's setting up the stage for the later one, he literally also does it, where like he's literally pulling the Nimis and stuff that she's going to use later.
Mm. Should we talk about this section? Like, it's pretty wild, the nightmares that she gives these people, right?
Yeah, Alpi's fucked up. We've had jokes from the Kenneteers about how she needs to like cool her jets with these nightmares. She really needs to fucking cool her jets with these nightmares. She makes one dude wet himself. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's very... It's like with John's interlude, where this interlude really prevents us from just hand-waving away the monstrousness of these characters that we like. This is quite horrifying, and Alpi just kind of does it without comment.
Yeah, like, it's hard to tell how much of this is outside what she would have just been doing in her regular job anyway.
Mm.
There's totally a read where she would have been doing 80% of this anyway.
It's, yeah, like, this is just what she does.
Especially because the first thing she does, actually, is she kind of approaches this family and she links them to her own. She's sort of like, oh, this reminds me of my family, like a bunch of kids, you know, hard times, shit, this is just like my family. Well, better torture the fuck out of them.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, she doesn't take that step of empathy after, like, connecting to them. It's, yeah.
No, yeah, that's not her. That's not her bag.
And I mean, I don't think it's a mistake that she barely speaks with her burr in this chapter until, like, right at the end, because I think that has been consistently one of the more, like, endearing parts of Alpi.
Mm.
And it's essentially non-present for most of this chapter.
That's a good call out. Yeah. It again just helps to kind of disconnect her from the Alpi that we know and love.
Yeah. Because I definitely feel like this chapter, it intersperses little reminders of like, remember, Alpi is doing this. Like there's a part halfway through Raph's dream specifically where there's just this line thrown in of like, instinct and years of studying let her find the means with which to break him. And it's like just lines like that peppered in just so like you can remember, as all this stuff with Raph's going on, it's just like, hey, and also just a reminder, Alpi is doing this. Like, she's let's all stop pretending that she's a little you know, Miss Nightmare, oh, I'm so overworked in my job. Like, she's fucked up.
Mm. Yeah.
One last reveal from this first segment that I want to pull in before we sort of go into the real meat of the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
That she runs into this one guy and he's like too drunk for her to actually do anything with. So she just sits on his chest and like basically paralyzes him and then lets him see her as the nightmare. And this is just like so clearly like sleep paralysis demon stuff. And I just love this idea that sometimes sleep paralysis demons are just like, a mare comes to you and they can't figure out how to scare you. So they just fucking look at me.
Yeah, I'll just do it the old fashioned way.
Oh, your dreams are just boring. I'm just going to like scare you in real life. Like, just, I don't know. That was just a bit of a funny moment.
It's a good moment, isn't it? So yeah, Alpi brings the witch hunter into a shared dream, measuring his responses to the various things she exposes him to using the other dreamers.
Yeah, and like most of this stuff in the dreams is something that's really hard to do justice in the podcast format, because it's impossible to pull out every cool detail, because we'll be here for like 4 hours being like, oh, and there's this cool detail. There's just so many of them. So this will just have to be my sort of blanket statement of this whole rest of this chapter has fascinating little details from top to bottom, and we're not going to get to call all of them out, but it, you know, you've all read it. It's a fantastically horrifying ride.
Yeah, it's very good, isn't it? It's very fun as she's just kind of poking and prodding at his psyche.
Yeah, it's like it turns into this really fun sort of detective game where we're like following along, trying to piece together the clues about like Raph and like, you know, Alpi's poking him and prodding him and drawing some of her own conclusions, and you're trying to like follow it along with her and see if you can make any of your own. It's like a fun game of him being tortured. I don't know. Very cool.
Yeah, it's good. It's again, the all this dream and stuff just works on so many levels, right? Because Alpi's motive is to attempt to figure out Raph, but as she's doing that, she's also growing her ability to dive another level deeper, which like makes perfect sense with the dream logic, because the better Raph is understood by Alpi, the more Alpi will know kind of what buttons to push to get into more personal nightmares. It's just like, it all just works so neatly and cleanly.
Just the concept of this chapter is such a fucking cool idea, like this interrogation by dreaming. It's like so much cooler than any other dream related thing I've ever seen, like including Inception. Like this sort of two birds thing where, so there's a moment, if I can jump ahead a bit, where obviously Alpi just sort of pulls out Melissa to see where Melissa will fit in, and Melissa sort of slots into the role of Raph's younger sister. We obviously learn that detail later, but this is such a great example of how Wabo's not just giving us Raph's backstory. Like, we're not doing a flashback or something. We don't just see Raph's backstory, but because we're using this fuzzy dream logic, we can also comment on current thinking by dropping Melissa in this role. And so, as well as telling us what happened to him, we also get details like, oh yeah, and he's already slotting Melissa in his head into like a similar position as his little sister. And that tells us so much about the other parts of this. Like, this chapter is doing so much and using fuzzy dream logic as such a great vehicle to do a bunch of things. It's just really cool.
Yes, I think the Melissa connection is a very interesting one as well, because I think if Alpi hadn't pulled this specific nightmare up, that plug wouldn't have happened. And I think it's very interesting to think about, is that going to prove to be a good thing or a bad thing? Like, will Raph seeing Melissa as kind of a sister figure that needs to be protected, will that be good? Will that mean that he's going to like overextend himself trying to save her, or will it be bad? Will he really try and get her on side and maybe, you know, recruit her? Like, I think it's very interesting that this is set up in a dream, and I'm sure we'll start to play out more when we get more Raph and Melissa interactions.
Yeah. Well, should we launch into that whole thing that we talked about earlier? With Raph and Melissa, because I am actually keen on the idea of her going with him and becoming a witch hunter.
Why? I guess I had kind of assumed if Melissa goes with Raph, that will be a betrayal for the Kenneteers. But it seems like you're saying there's a way for this to be resolved amicably, and that would include Melissa going off with Raphael.
Yeah, I want this fact that he is relating to Melissa to be the wedge that the Kenneteers get to use to resolve get through this to
him. Yeah.
Peacefully. Yeah, because I think...
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get into it more, but he's obviously fairly biased against practitioners and for good reason. I see Melissa being like this wedge that they can sort of use so that everyone comes out of this with cool things. And like, her new abilities would be great for witch hunters, but even just the concept of witch hunters feels like this great missing piece for like something like Kennet. So if you forget about all the Carmine stuff and you look at like what Kennet was trying to be as this haven for others, and then as it grew, they had to integrate some practitioners. And what better way to add like another check of the balance of power to the practitioners over the others than to add something like witch hunters? Like, I could see Melissa going and training at the lighthouse for the rest of the summer or whatever, and then coming back and being like a witch hunter stationed in Kennet. And I might be more optimistic about how witch hunters work as an institution than maybe I should be, because I don't know if everyone there is like as fucking Winchester-y kill all monsters as Raph is. But the fact that they're being hired by practitioners makes me think they're a little bit more flexible than that. And this idea of having this haven of nice others with a witch hunter kind of posted there and like integrated with the council, it just feels like another vector with which the Kenneteers can continue to get everyone working together and add layers of safety and checks and balances to the system.
Okay. Look, I don't hate this thought, although I do want snarky Melissa to be more a part of the Kenneteers team, I guess. So I would feel sad that we would miss out.
Well, if she's like the witch hunter representative for...
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it wouldn't be within the context of this story, I suppose. But
yes.
You know, we could rest safe with the knowledge in the epilogue that she is permanently sort of by their side, making sure they don't turn corrupt, and that would be very fun.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I guess witch hunters represent an interesting twist in what we've got right now, where they're, again, another force that needs to be negotiated with before Kennet can be something that feels permanent, right? Like, are they going to murder every witch hunter that comes along? No, there needs to be some kind of more permanent solution to this. So, given that we know Raph is connected to this wider witch hunter network, I could kind of see that this being the stepping stone to setting that up, but... Or even if not kind of tangibly, at least kind of building a bridge that can be used there. Interesting. I like it. We'll see. I definitely think there needs to be a diplomatic resolution to this Raphael encounter.
I hope there will be. I just see the concept of witch hunters in general as this really interesting other avenue to add to this wider system. Because just this idea that, you know, if we're going to try and fix things more wide scale, I think the idea of having these people who are seemingly a real match for practitioners, considering Raph was like chosen to come and kill some, that just feels important to me. That it's like they're like just another angle that we can add to the wider spectrum of who we consider in terms of how we balance power.
Yeah, definitely needs to be considered. I don't necessarily think that Melissa going off with Raph will have to tie into that, but I do like the thought about it. So we'll have to see, I guess.
Yeah, just anything to help move power away from the practitioners. Like, because I was, remember, yes. Alex said that thing in 7.x where he was like, it's like the Wild West for us. There are no police officers for practitioners.
Mm.
Here's some. Let's use
them. Yeah, here they are. Right on schedule. Interesting thought.
I also want to say, talking about like the detective game of playing with Alpi in the dream, something I didn't see Alpi pull out, but like seemed like a pattern to me, is Raph really seems to favor wide open spaces. Like he avoids being contained or trapped, which obviously makes sense given his like origin story. But you know, the fact that he started Kennet's lockdown in this big open field and like forest, like it just feels like, I'm going to be keeping my eye on that going forward. I feel like Raph is going to be somebody who avoids being trapped and contained because he wants to always have freedom to move.
Possibly a. I mean, we see why obviously from this nightmare, yeah. But possibly a way to get under his skin if we need to have a conflict with him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, we're seeing Raph's nightmare. After a small motor accident, Raph is separated from the others. When he tries to find them, he enters a horror movie. It's the milkmaid! She's back from that, what was it? It was like a packed dice extra material. It was like a Reddit comment. That's what it was.
Yeah. So the milkmaid was somebody who was touched on outside of packed. I love that. I don't know the comment well enough to say if somebody who hasn't read Pact should go and read it, but like, she was talked about on Reddit years ago, so it's one of those word of God becoming canon moments.
It's the question was effectively like, hey, what do others do all day when other things aren't around? And Wilbo basically wrote a day in the life of an other thing with Milkmaid as the protagonist, I guess. Fuck, this is horrifying, right?
I mean, this was a lot of fun to read. Like, this is just a straight up horror movie. I mean, obviously it's a dream, so things are like a little bit fuzzy, but I think we're sort of meant to assume that this is, you know, 90% what happened, just with some people swapped around.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah, my favorite bit is the moment where Tess is like, I'm gonna jump out this window, and if I survive the landing, please find a way to kill me. And like Rafazoi just rocked up and he's like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
It's horrifying. And speaking of how horrifying this is, you know, in this horror movie, Raph is the protagonist and the milkmaid is the villain, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Extrapolating that out, we then can see, well, this isn't that dissimilar from Kennet, where while we're not in Raph's perspective, from his perspective, you know, he's tracking down Liz, who is a mass murderer, and finding an insidious conspiracy that he obviously would have to destroy. It was kind of a real are we the baddies moment, right?
No, there's a moment in the previous chapter where he reveals he's been hired to come and kill the Kenneteers specifically. So he's not, he is here on a contract to kill some 13-year-old girls. So that's not super heroic. But yeah, that said, I mean, he talks about this later. He does rock up and is like, yeah, so about 10 minutes into being in your town, I ran into this like doppelganger that killed like two groups of witch hunters. So yeah, your town seems pretty shit. And wait, it's very easy to put yourself in Raph's head and see why he feels so justified in what he's doing.
Yeah, 100%. Worth noting, this horror movie with the milkmaid isn't just an other. There's a practitioner here who has formed a symbiotic relationship with her, allowing her and maybe even enabling her to do what she does, right? And from Raph's perspective, Kennet probably isn't different. And that's maybe not even wrong. Like, the Kenneteers are allowing and kind of even endorsing at least minor horrors like Alpi's Nightmares and the Goblins' shenanigans, right?
Yeah, well, like, that's the thing. Like Raph's whole thing is he comes in with this idea that practitioners and others are just exploiting humans and taking stuff from them to empower themselves.
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah,
that's not wrong.
Yeah,
like, he obviously...
Totally.
He, you know, obviously we know that there's exceptions and Alpi makes that case and we'll get into all that. But like, yeah, obviously they're the ones he ran into here. And like, you know, for all that Kennet is trying to be all of the nice others together and stuff.
Yeah.
Girl by Candlelight just killed someone. They had the Hungry Choir living here for years. That was killing off people by the dozen.
Yeah.
Wait, and obviously, yeah, we went to the Blue Heron Institute. Most of the people there were real shits. Like, it's... He's not wrong. He's just failing to see the ones... Yeah, that's exactly what Alpi says. He's failing to give mercy to the ones who aren't the problem, and then that's just, like, causing more harm than good.
Yeah.
But his perspective is extremely understandable, given
100%
this world and
is.
What he's seen.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. There's... Given what he has seen and his experiences, I'm firmly on the side of, yeah... It, what he's doing makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Like, and that's why it's going to be so interesting to see where like negotiations can possibly go, because he has a very good case for why he is the way he is.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing I quickly want to talk about in this section is obviously something that features very heavily in this dream is this angel thing that's on the car, and it's clear that he's like linked that to the miracle of getting away from the milkmaid. But then also, like, there is other church stuff in there, and I'm just wondering, like, if Raph is like overtly religious, because that would be our first like straight up religious character in this story, right? I mean, like, in the sense that that we have religious people in real life, like, obviously somebody who like just meets gods. Like, that, I'm not counting someone like Ulysses who, like, met his god and struck a deal. Like, that's not...
He's not religious,
That's not faith in the same way. like, in real life, people aren't, like, getting, you know, straight-up miracle powers and, like, clubs and stuff from God, as far as I'm aware.
Well, we just don't tell you about it, Elliot.
So, like, yeah, I don't know. That just feels like a really interesting angle to me. Like, yeah, how faith and religion fits into both somebody like this and just this world in general.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder. I wonder how it would be interesting to explore. I think Wabo's probably shied away from it because it would be such a complicated thing to do in a world where gods are real, you know?
Yeah, I mean, most urban fantasy stuff tends to shy away from bringing like active world religions into the stories in a major way, because it's like, yeah, you don't want to be bringing like, you know, the gods or the, you know, prophets or whatever that people worship and turning them into like, yeah, you know, Jesus was an aware or something. Like, you don't
yeah, or like, do that. You know, God's actually an author that just writes books about our protagonists or anything like that. Yeah. Oh, God. You definitely wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I don't know. I'd just be interested. I wouldn't want this story to go in the direction of like commenting on or like the Christian God or Jesus, yes. But like just the idea of where faith fits into someone's life in this world still feels interesting to me.
Yeah, you're right. A faith that is unverifiable, I guess. I think that would be an interesting thing to explore.
We'll see, exactly.
I guess. So yeah, Raph escapes from the milkmaid and is recruited to become a witch hunter. A throwaway line in this nightmare about nightmares twigs for him, and he kind of snaps back to reality after a brief conversation with Alpi.
Yes, and I want to pull out this one line that is given to him by I copy pasted this name, and now I'm realizing I have to say it.
Semenego. Yeah.
Sorry to everyone who knows how that name should be said. This guy says to him, "We hunt them, jury and executioner only. No judges to adjudicate, no court." I mean, obviously, in this story, you can't let a line go like that go past you. Like this pretty explicitly ties Raph and the whole witch hunter deal into the themes of the story, and highlights like the problem with their methodology that we're going to have. It's like exactly the sort of black and white rhetoric we've criticized Rook for having.
Mm.
Yeah, it's like as the, you know, they sort of say they're the jury or whatever, but it's like, you know, there's no judgment. It's just as soon as you have been decided guilty by the jury, which is them, they will execute you.
Yeah, it's, well, yeah, I mean, you're right. It ties into, like, it really is explicitly starting to say, hey, what's the, let's bring in our core themes of the judicial system, I guess, into Raph here.
Yeah, and explicitly the witch hunters are seemingly on some level against any idea of actually hearing you out. Like, yes, it's a worse or at least as bad version of what Rook is about, where it's like as soon as they have decided that you are what you are, you get got.
But like, it's interesting because the thought of, you know, you don't get a trial, right, is an interesting one, and one that is obviously a bit off-putting to us. But, you know, the closest thing we've seen to a trial in this world, I would say, is Seth defending himself against being forsworn. And that didn't feel fair in any way, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like this world, I don't know if it allows for the concept of fair trials. I don't know what that would look like, you know?
I suppose it comes back to something like others have often said to the Kenneteers, which is that words are the weapons of practitioners.
Yeah.
And that makes putting them or giving them a chance to make their case potentially dangerous.
Yeah, because, and inherently one-sided, at least to some extent, proposition, right?
Yeah, but I don't know. The idea of just automatically going, well, I mean, okay, the real reason that this sort of logic falls flat to me here is because this guy sells it as, you know, we hunt them, we're the jury and the executioner. You know, there's no judges to adjudicate, no court. But then also, Raph has been hired to come and kill the Kenneteers. So it's like, well, no, okay, clearly there is a judge and it's whoever's paying you. Like, like he's not here to kill the others. He doesn't feel like he's going out of his way to kill every other. He's specifically targeting the Kenneteers. Because that's what he's been hired to do. So it's like, well, no, okay, there is a judge. The judge is whoever's, you know, giving you the money.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. it is a bit hypocritical, isn't it?
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I'm interested, to see where this goes, especially because I can't help but tie this to Crooked Rook in my head. So I wonder if that connection will go anywhere.
Mm. Yeah. We'll see, I suppose. Then the other thing that's worth touching on from this part is this conversation with Alpi, where Alpi talks about there being more of us, she says, you know, I can pronounce it if you want. I'm trying to not just do the horrible
the accent.
Okay, sure. Here's the direct quote. There are more of us, the monsters. No.
There are more of us than the monsters like the milkmaid, Raphael. Some of us only want peace. You're focusing on the wrong things. Does more harm than good.
Which I think I slipped into the guy who's Jack Sparrow's second in command there for a bit. Yeah, I apologize, but...
My Scottish accent always devolves into Irish.
The key part of the conversation, accents aside, is Alpi tries to say, hey, this is more nuanced than you are treating it. But obviously, because she's just spent time giving him nightmares, that's a hard pitch and it doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of, it's this real moment of like, so I know I have just been torturing you, but like some of us aren't that bad actually. So yeah, it's a real tough sell right at the moment. I'll be kind of frames him as someone who's on a crusade and whose mind can't be changed. So yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know. We will see. But yeah, from the one thing that comes out of this conversation, the one positive from this conversation, is Alpi knows some shit is going down. She notices that some things don't sit right with the timelines for Liz and Sig, and decides she needs to talk to somebody about this, but the Kenneteers are unavailable, so she decides to go to Rook and to Mariska instead.
Yeah, I love how she sort of pieces this together. That hadn't really clicked for me as a reveal until Walbur spelt it out for us. I love how, as much as like we're building up to this like witch hunter fight and we dealt with the wolf and stuff, in all of these interludes, we're also really establishing the teams that are forming in Kennet in a really fun way.
Yeah, it's worrying that Alpi, I mean, it's nice to know that Alpi's definitely on Team Kennet here, but it's worrying that she says, oh, I'm going to talk to Rook and Mariska. It's very much drawing lines that I don't like, especially Mariska, right? It makes me worry for Alpi a bit, that line.
God, I was actually almost as worried about Rook, because I've just been worried about Alpi getting swept up by Rook since day one.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That seems like it's been set up from the get-go, doesn't it?
But I'm really liking how we're sort of focusing on taking a lot of these others and sort of showing us where they're going to be standing as we start to head into, you know, presumably eventually we're going to start to, you know, fight over the furs and what Kennet is. And this, all these interludes are really sort of starting to establish where those lines are. And also doing it in that cool way where like none of the interludes have been from the like quote unquote leadership of any of the teams. Like we're not seeing Rook, we're not seeing Edith and Matt, we're seeing the support crews like Sig, Alpi right here. Like it's not, and like Chloe, it's not the sort of main players. It's like we're learning where everyone else is going to line up behind them.
Yeah.
Which sadly means no Toad Swallow interlude.
Well, yeah, you're right.
Because he's the leader of his team, so.
Yes, but maybe that means we'll get like a, I don't know, Doglick interlude or something, or the Cherry Pop interlude that we've been waiting for a long time.
We'll Ram see. Jam would be another one, maybe just because he got that moment at the end of Arc 9 where he was like introduced all of a sudden. We saw Pekkasnot in 5.D. I'd love to see more of that little guy.
I don't know. Maybe it, instead of being a single character interlude, it would be a kind of group interlude where we cut between a few goblins. I could see that happening.
I'm all for that. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that rounds out this chapter.
Yeah. Alpi has apparently decided that she's going to lean towards Marcy and Rook, which is not where we want her to be. Raph is a crusader, so that's fun.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that milkmaid stuff.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? It was pretty horrifying.
You know the part that got me the most, like actually the thing that made me the most upset? It was the mutant calf at the front.
Oh, yeah. It was all pretty horrifying. That might have been the most horrifying thing we've seen in Pale. Like, I think the Hungry Choir was probably... Sorry, like, Gabe's interlude specifically was probably that for a while.
Yeah.
I think this has overtaken it. It's just
It's got to be right up there, yeah.
Yeah.
But there was a theme park near where I grew up, and there was a museum there of like deformed farm animal fetuses and stuff. And that place scared the shit out of me as a kid, but we kept going. So just that image of like the deformed calf. It was
that's horrifying. It
triggered some stuff. The whole theme park was
wild. Sounds insane. Yeah.
Wait, hold on. I'm going to send you an image. I know this is terrible podcasting, but check out this slide that was at this theme park.
All right. I'm looking at this slide now. I'm just going to describe it to everybody. Oh, my God. Okay. So it's maybe the most homemade looking slide. It looks like a water slide with no water on it. It looks like the kind of thing that will literally burn you if you slide down it.
There's the potato sacks on the ground there.
Oh, I see.
So you have to hop in one of those, especially on hot days, because on hot days, the metal would get to like 100 degrees Celsius. So if you touched it, it would burn your skin.
Jesus Christ.
So they keep cold water at the bottom in case you got burns on the way down. But like, because you had to really stay in the potato sack, otherwise you'd get burnt. It was so much fun.
Sounds
anyway,
so much fun. And with that, that's the end of our discussion of these chapters. There's no extra material this week, so let's move on to pulling out some predictions from our community left in our Pale Predictor form. I'm going to pull out mine first because I think it's great. Mine is from user Ghostly Bird, who is predicting Marisica is a red herring. I mean, I'm kind of dialing it down, but effectively, Marisica is a red herring. The actual fae culprit is Guillemay. I've been thinking about this for myself as well, because like obviously Marisica is the one that has been the most strongly hinted at being a culprit the entire story, right? Like the entire time she's been the one that we've been like, yeah, it's probably Marcy. But the clues that implicate Marcy, I think, do probably implicate Guillemay too. And Ghostly Bird makes the good point that Guillemay has been said to be better at this like trickery and subterfuge stuff than Marisica. So that also quite tracks. I think this is a great prediction. I think we'll probably know if this is true or not by the end of this arc. And I'm probably sitting about 50-50 on who the real villain is of the two.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely possible. I do like this as a theory. I'm just still, ever since we got that first prediction from, I think it was actually just a bird, which I think is a different person, that Guillemay was like a goodie. I've never been able to let that go, but it's been almost borderline suspicious how absent from the story he's been since they got back. I don't know. I hope we get to see more of him soon. Like he keeps not playing his part, and that makes me suspicious. Just fall to winter already, you nerd.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? But then again, we don't know how long the time frame of that's meant to be. Like maybe that is a thing that each part takes years to play out, you know? So what prediction did you pull out, Elliot?
I just pulled out a nice quick one from Juff. And Juff just says, the eponymous character for this arc is Matthew because he is the one after and other, which is the girl by candlelight.
I love that. It's a great, it's terrible, stupid pun.
Yeah, it's a fun little pun for you.
It reminds me of, I was watching a show, a great show that I strongly recommend to everyone called Watchmen. And one of the titles to an episode in that show is just like the stupidest pun I've ever heard. Because one of the main characters' surnames is A-Bar, and so the pun is a thing walks into a bar. It's very, very stupid. God. But I really love that energy, and I love that Juff is hoping that Wabo's brought that energy to this story too, because I think it's hilarious.
Yeah. So hopefully, I guess we'll see. I'm still curious to learn more about how Matthew and Edith are working. Are they together? Are they not? What's the deal there?
Elliot has just sent me another picture of something from this. I mean, you can't call it an amusement park, but
it was made by the family. If you can believe it, this one family built it themselves.
I can believe it because it looks terrible and terrifying.
That's called the rocking horse. That one.
We'll put the links to this in our show notes down below. Also, in our show notes, you will find the link to our discussion thread where you can leave your answer to our discussion question, which we'll be talking about next week. The discussion question is, how the fuck can someone help Melissa? So I think we'll see some interesting responses to that in the story, but also get your responses into it in the discussion thread, which we'll link down below.
Yeah, obviously the story has started to touch on it, but I'm curious, like, especially, I think when we initially pitched this question, part of our angle was like, also, just how do you help someone like this in real life? Like someone who doesn't want help?
Mm.
So I'm curious to hear more about how people think that might work. Obviously, Alyssa and Lucy talked about it, but still.
Mm. Yeah. So post your answers in the discussion thread.
Yeah. You can also check us out on Twitter. Just search for Pale Reflections. The live reads are there. The episode announcements are there. And it's a cool place to hang.
Yeah. While you're looking for cool places to hang, I guess, is the segue I'm going to go with. you can go to doofmedia.com to check out all the other great content on the Doof Media website. We just did a Doof and Chill earlier today, which is our monthly stream where we just kind of hang out with patrons and members of the community. If you want to get access to those, you can become a patron and you'll find out about them. Today we played Jackbox games. It was a bunch of fun. Elliot, how can people get in on that?
If you just head to patreon.com/doofmedia, you can get all the details on like how our Patreon works. It's pretty straightforward. The lowest tier gets you access to Doof and Chill. There's a bunch of other perks at other tiers, so check it out.
Yeah. Please do. While you're on Patreon, why not check out Wildbo's Patreon as well, of course, at patreon.com/Wildbo, because he has created this beautiful space for us to enjoy each and every week and deserves some joy for that. Joy is what I call money.
So with that, we'll see you all next week for more One After Another.
Yeah. See you then. See you, folks.
God, this is the connection for this episode.
Sorry, the delay.
It's going to be such a pain to edit.
I'm hoping that a lot of it was just silences that can be truncated.
Yeah, I just hope the episode flows. I'm worried there's going to be so many bits where one of us makes a point, pauses, and then just makes the next one because the other person didn't say it.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Oh, anyway, all right.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.